This is episode number 727 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in our What's New segment, we're going to talk about Hudson Valley Comic Con, the Pandorica Restaurant, Spider-Man, and more. Our comics this week will be Amazing Spider-Man number 12, Punisher number 1, Dungeons & Dragons Shadow of the Vampire number 1, and ROM Space Knight number 0. And finally, this week's creator spotlight is our good friend Alana Abbott, who has a new game coming out called Choice of the Pirate, which I talked to her about this week.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
God, clean the hole for fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here as always with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the Star Wars t-shirt clad Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, so I apologize right up front about my voice.
But you have a spiffy new haircut, and I feel like that's going to carry you through.
I think so.
This episode.
Yep. I posted on Facebook and somebody said, "You paid for that haircut?" That was really funny.
I like it.
I like the heat, the heat it radiates, I like, but I like that it's so cool during the summer.
It's not a mohawk, it's like a head hawk.
Yeah,
because it's the whole top of your head.
Yeah, they call it a frohawk, apparently.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yep, so that's what I got.
I'd also like to welcome to the show the landscapers that are out and about doing their work in your neighborhood, which is uncanny.
Yes.
How every time we record, the lawnmowers start up. We're in the basement.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that we have a street like a little bit down from us right now where we're recording that is being developed. They've already put 6-7 houses in, big, huge houses.
Yep.
But now we're hearing the pipes trucks and the wood deliveries and all these trucks because you're hearing the beep, beep, beep.
Yep.
So I'm thinking I'm at work hearing these things, but that's...
So if it sounds like we are recording in the midst of a construction site or down at the docks
where the freighters are
coming in with their with their cargo, then that is what it is.
That's exactly it.
Until we get a completely vacuum-sealed, soundproofed studio to record in, which, with all the advertising money that we're making, should be not long from now.
Yeah, and
probably by episode 7,000, we will have our own recording studio.
Yeah, I told my daughter, because she's a musician and is using down here to record, I said, you know what? Start putting stuff on YouTube. Make some money so you can redo this whole thing.
Yeah.
But she is the, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Dad, I can't record quality unless it's soundproof.
Uh-huh.
But you need the money to get the equipment to soundproof. Mm-hmm. Yes, but, and it's not even worth the argument.
Yeah. So you get lawnmowers. That's what you get. All right, let's jump into our news. You were at a comic convention this past weekend, one that you had never attended before.
The Hudson Valley Comic Con. It was a first year show. And for those who don't know where the Hudson Valley is, and this was my first time even out that way, it is sort of the area in between upstate Albany, New York, and New York City. It is literally right in the middle. And for anybody in the New England area, you drive down 84 all the way to the very end, and where you would take a left to go to New York City, a right to go to Albany, you go right, and it's probably 45 minutes in. It's very mountainous. It's a beautiful area. And when I got off the exit, from the second I got there, I'm lost. Yes, the GPS is telling me where to go, but I'm still thinking I'm in the wrong spot.
Sure.
And the Hudson Valley Comic Con was held at a Gold's Gym there.
Interesting.
And I thought that was a really interesting location for a show.
Did you get any squats in, like in between book sales or anything?
Well, it was interesting that you saw the people, because what they did was, and this is the setup that I thought was amazing. All the vendors were on the soccer field. They have that AstroTurf soccer field where when you're walking on it, there's little pebbles that
kind of cushion. So it's a big Gold Gym.
Huge.
Okay.
Then all the artist alley area was on the basketball court. So I have a picture that I got to show you where I was right below a basket.
Nice.
And then on the other side of that, there was sort of a fake wall. And then there was the panel room. So the panel room was literally 3 steps away from where I was.
Huh.
And the panel room seated probably 400 and people were coming in. But a first year show, And again, this is an area, it was a lot like the Vermont Comic Con that I went, that it is an area starved for anything geek, because you saw tons and tons of homemade costumes. You had families coming in with a father with a Batman mask. The mother had, you know, a Harley Quinn, the tendril hat that she has, the jester hat. And then the kids all had something. It was just like, let's dress up, let's go have fun, not let's dress up and stop traffic. It was just an amazing show. There was a newspaper report that said that there were 1,000 people there throughout the course of, I guess, the first day, and the actual number was 4,000.
Wow.
I did a noontime panel, and it was about quarter of, and I have to give a big shout out to Kayla Smith. So Kayla sent a couple volunteers over to say, hey, you know, your panel's going on. One of us will take you to the panel, and I'm going to stay at your table, which is great considering I'm new to this place. I don't know anybody.
And that's a huge issue, dude, because usually when you and I are not together,
yeah,
when we don't go to shows together, we're completely by ourselves.
Yeah.
And so leaving your table is scary.
Yeah. So these volunteers, it was these two young girls, and I told them, I said, you don't have to do anything. They're like, oh, no, we just tell everybody you're going to be back at 1.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, perfect. So,
which is really what you need, dude, because it's not even so much that you're worried about somebody taking something. It's just that people are going by the table and you're not there.
Yeah.
And so not having someone to say, oh, they're doing a panel right now, or oh, they'll be back in a few minutes, is just people walking by saying, huh, well, I guess they're not interested enough to stay behind their table.
Yeah. So Kayla was walking around with a megaphone going into every avenue going, and there's a Doctor Who panel at 12 o'clock. You know, if you're interested, come on over. And the room, again, I walked in there and it was like, holy cow, there's like 12 people in this room. There's 50,000 more empty seats as to people. And that's a little, and then they're all spread out.
Right.
So it's a little intimidating, a little bothersome. And then by the time I went up, and they were right on it, they're like, all right, noon, you're up. So I'd walk up on stage. And by the time I got out on stage, it was probably half full.
Yep.
I mean, everybody that was there that wanted to go to the panel were there. Had a great time. And of course I walk off going, I blew it. I stunk. I scared everybody off. I bombed. Went back to the table and there were probably 25 people there waiting for me to come back. So I sold every book, every Doctor Who book, but one I had.
That's awesome.
Which was an amazing, amazing time. And next to me, and this is the other big thing, is like when you get to someplace, you hope that your neighbors are really cool people. And, Jerry Klein and Al Matra, and Al is an amazing artist. I got some of his stuff up on my Facebook page, on our Secret Identity page. And you can go to matraart.com, Matra Art, to see some of his amazing stuff. We're going to work together on my new book project. I'm trying to get you to look at some of his stuff. So maybe you could use him as well. I mean, this guy's got a great feel. And once again, talented people, but nicer people than they are talented, which is what you want from a show, but
from a neighbor.
Yes. An amazing time. We had a blast. And you're almost sad when you're done because it's like, oh, when are we going to see each other again? I had a ton of fun talking and great people. The whole area was just fantastic. I had a blast.
Oh, that's awesome. So you also went to a restaurant this week.
Yes. And when we finished up the show, local businesses really stepped up to help sponsor this show. There were some really odd choices, like, the Bath Fitters that were there. They were there, but they were, you know, it's like, why would they be here sponsoring a comic show, or why do they have a bath setup thing? And if you don't know who they are, they're the people that give you the fake tubs to put over your crappy tubs, so then you have a nice tub.
Uh-huh.
But they were sponsors of the show, and a lot of local businesses really stepped up to help this show get off the ground. And one of the places was the Pandorica, which is in Beacon, New York, about a half hour from where we were in Poughkeepsie. And it is a Doctor Who themed restaurant. This is a place that's been open for about a year and a half. And all my Whovian friends have been raving about this place. And I decided that it was, you know, I'm down here, I need to go.
It was high time that you made a visit.
So I walked in, and it was funny because all the people that I met, all the groups that were there, I walk in and the place was mobbed. I'm like, oh, this is great. But the problem was the place was so mobbed, I had nowhere to sit with people because all the tables were all full. They're like, hey, man. I'm like, oh, you got no room for me. Well, I'm going to go sit with these guys. Oh, you got no room for me. So I ended up sitting with some folks I never even met before, which was really cool. We had a great time.
But when you're at that restaurant, you know that you have something that you're going to be able to talk about.
Everybody has something in common, and you spend the most time looking at everything around you. You walk in, and there is a weeping angel at the very front, a huge life-size weeping angel. There is an oud that is to the left at the desk when you first walk in. You go into the bathroom. There's an Agent of Silent upside down, and then on the bathroom door, there's check marks, so you make sure you remember that you saw him. Huge art displays all over the place. It was a lot of fun. And again, for a restaurant, the most important part is their food. Because even if you have a Doctor Who ambiance, if the food is terrible, you're not going to go. I had the Aryumi Mummy meatloaf.
I like it. Yeah.
It was fantastic. Huge portions. I don't want to say it was pricey, because, but it's a little bit more than you would pay anywhere else.
Sure.
But it was what you would expect to pay at a restaurant, like a theme restaurant kind of thing.
And you got your money's worth?
Oh, the portions were great, and the meatloaf was wrapped in bacon.
Because that's where they lose me, is when I go to a place and not only is it expensive, but they have baby portions.
Yep.
Like, when I order a steak, I don't want an 8-ounce steak.
Yeah.
I don't want a 10-ounce steak. I want a minimum of a 16-ounce steak.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's good to hear. We'll have to stop at that one. That sounds like a show that I want to go to next year.
Yeah, and so I'm also planning on doing a book thing at the Pandorica sometime in, I think, mid-June. We're just trying to find the right dates to work this out, but I'm very excited. And, yeah, again, the food was fantastic. Everybody, I mean, plates that were being dropped in front of me, they gave me a salad. Yeah, that got passed over to the people next to me.
I'm surprised you didn't just sweep that directly off the table and shatter the bowl all over the floor.
Yeah, and speaking of bowls, it was funny because somebody said, hey, everything is Doctor Who themed here. Why don't you have Doctor Who plates, Doctor Who glasses? And she goes, because we want to keep our stuff here.
Right.
You know what would happen. You'd finish the
Absolutely.
Plate, clean it off, throw it in your purse or your pocket, and out the door
you went. Oh, look, it's a sonic screwdriver fork. That's mine.
That's mine.
Yep.
So very, very – the cuttery and the crockery is all very basic, but great, great place.
Well, I have a couple of things on the news items this week. First of all, Perry McCants, who you know, Matthew, because he does work for the Monarch Comics Witch Hunter series.
Yes.
And Perry McCants actually illustrated the story, The Handyman, which I did for the Monarch Comic Chronicles book that debuted last year. And Perry actually has a new YouTube channel, and it's called Comic Book Stories Told, and I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes. But basically, he's doing like a motion comic thing where he's taking bits and pieces of comics and narrating over them and reading the dialogue and stuff like that. And he had emailed me this past week because he wanted to do one with The Handyman.
Mm.
And so hopefully that's something that's going to go up soon.
Very
but there
cool.
is a couple issues of Witch Hunter that he has up on the site right now, which are pretty cool. So I'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's Comic Book Stories Told that he is doing, and there's a lot more to come because the channel really has kind of just started. Also, I was a guest on the Gotham by Geeks podcast this week.
Ooh.
I'm not sure when the episode is going to go up, but I know Daryl will let us know. So, of course, Daryl Taylor, the Taylor Network of podcasts. This is one of the myriad of podcasts that he does. But it is a podcast about all things Gotham. Mm. And not the television show,
no.
but things in the Bat universe. And so we had talked a few weeks ago about me possibly coming on the show and what did I want to talk about. And so I chose to talk about the 4-issue arc from the Stephanie Brown Batgirl run, and it was called Flood. And it was the one where the Calculator, who is the father of Wendy,
yes.
comes to town and he creates a virus with some apocalypse technology where everybody is getting turned into like techno-organic zombies. And it was great on many different levels. But so I gushed about that. But it's Daryl, Russ, Mike, and Chris that do the show on a weekly basis. And not only do they talk about the different Batman comics, they pick old issues, a lot of out of the long box type stuff where they're talking about single issues and stuff. And they are all infinitely more knowledgeable about the Bat universe than I am. I must have dropped your name about 15 times. I'm like, yeah, Matt usually explains that stuff to me. Or yeah, Matt was telling me about this because we talked about like, did I know the origin of Spoiler? I said, no, Matt fills me in on all that stuff because he's the Batman guy. And definitely a podcast that you would like to guest on at some point in time. And I'm sure Daryl would love to have you, but I'll put a link up when that show is going to air. But the like one of the discussion topics was your top 5 favorite Bat gadgets. And so, like, there's a new thing that they all come to the table with every single week. So, great show. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. That was a lot of fun. In actual comic book news this week, or comic movie news, now, Kevin, I think his name is Feige? but it's Feige, the guy who does the movies for Marvel.
Uh-huh.
I always say Kevin Feige.
Yeah.
But I don't know how else it's pronounced. But anyways, he talked to Deadline in this past week, because as everybody should know by now, it's not a spoiler, Spider-Man appears in the Civil War movie. And the reviews for Spidey's performance in that movie have been almost universally...
Yes.
You know, people love it.
Yep.
I will say, and we're going to talk about Civil War in our next episode, because you still have not seen it, Matt.
Seeing it tomorrow.
But I will tell you, as a Spider-Man fan, and I'll talk more about this when we talk about the movie, I did not think that I would be saying that he is by far the best Spider-Man that has ever appeared on film, but he is by far the best Spider-Man that's ever appeared on film. What the Russo brothers were able to do with about 20 minutes of time in that movie is nothing short of amazing.
Wow.
They made you understand what the vision of Spidey is going to be in this Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it is the one of him being back in high school as a kid, dealing with kid stuff. Tom Holland is everything that you would ever want from both Spider-Man and Peter Parker.
Wow.
Like, I cannot say enough about it. So rave reviews for that. So Deadline was talking to Kevin Feige about a bunch of different stuff, but Spider-Man came up and they said, take us behind the scenes a little with your involvement in this refreshing new iteration of Spider-Man, who feels like a glove fit in the Marvel Universe. I always heard that Sony rushed the films to battle the ticking clock, where the rights might revert if one wasn't made every few years. What can you say about the dynamic of you and Marvel getting directly involved as a producer and road testing Tom Holland in Civil War? Because that's basically what they did. They're like, this is the new version of Spidey. Is everybody cool with this?
Yeah.
Because this is what you're going to see in the next movie. And he said, it came down to an initial lunch between myself and Amy Pascal, and then many subsequent phone calls and meetings where I basically suggested that they should allow us to creatively produce the film for them. I don't know how serious any of these ticking clocks ever were. On some characters, that was the case. With Spider-Man, there was many years in between those films, and I don't think that was ever the case. They had all the time in the world to keep making those movies. It became a question of, we are not good at helping, just occasionally giving input or occasional feedback or comments in a screening or on a script. I had done that a little bit on the earlier Amazing Spider-Man films. It doesn't really work because you're one voice among many. I said, the only way, the best way that we could help is if you let us do it and it is marketed and distributed by the entire Sony team. The deal was agreed to over many discussions. Thankfully, it's now been well over a year, and step one in our two-step plan is unveiled this weekend. So far, the response has been a dream come true in introducing him. Instead of it being the third reboot of the Spider-Man character, it becomes the first version of Spider-Man that we reveal has been inside the MCU. And to Amy's credit, and to Tom Rothman, who has now been at the helm at Sony, as we've been actively putting it together, their support has been spectacular in allowing us to bring him into our world. Let's see. They asked him, the interviewer said, I read the comics in the 60s and you captured what I remembered. This young, spunky kid who had a tragedy with his murdered Uncle Ben, what was not defined and burdened by it. There was more of the wide-eyed wonder. He seems to be having a pretty good time. What about this Spider-Man most excited you? And he replied, he said, you nailed it. His presence in Civil War was meant to be a counterpoint. The other heroes have a lot of history together. They have a lot of angst. They have a lot of geopolitical issues that they're dealing with, and it's heavy. This kid basically feels like he hit the jackpot. The most famous man in the world, Tony Stark, asks him to go to Germany and participate with the Avengers, and he loves every minute of it. That's fun. He said, that's who Spider-Man is, and we can and will do much more of this in Spider-Man Homecoming. He said, you saw it in the comics. He constantly talks. In Civil War, he goes up against, I'm not going to spoil that for you guys. He said, that's what we love. Tom Holland, God bless him, is that in real life. This amazing young English actor who was brought over here, got into our audition process, and suddenly found himself in a room doing a scene with Robert Downey. I swear it is the exact dynamic we wanted between Peter Parker and Tony Stark, we had between Tom Holland and Robert Downey Jr. And I also read, in addition to that, that Robert Downey Jr. really worked with him in the first scene where he's introduced. And it's not really a huge spoiler, but you see him in his apartment and Tony Stark is waiting there for him. And they have this conversation. And what I had read is that Robert Downey Jr. really took a lot of time to work with him about what they wanted to accomplish in that scene and really get the most out of that scene. And like I said, to go back to what I think the Russo brothers did so amazingly, they squeezed so much out of every second that Spider-Man was on film that it felt like he was a bigger part of that movie. And I will say they also did the same thing with Black Panther.
Good.
I mean, like, they did all of those characters justice, and Ant-Man, freaking awesome. Like, everybody got their due, but boy, did they do right by Spider-Man. Like, anybody who was worried about this kid playing Spider-Man, forget about it.
Yeah, that's, like, all, that's all I've been hearing from everybody is, you know, it's like, how's the movie? Spider-Man was awesome.
That's, he was awesome. Yeah. I mean, I was grinning like an idiot the whole time. Like, from the second that he appeared on screen until the, I was just like an idiot, just sitting there grinning. Like, I can't even believe this. This is awesome. So great, great stuff. That was an interesting interview. So what it sounds like is Marvel is basically full hands-on in this new version of Spider-Man. And if they share the profits with Sony and Sony does marketing on it, whatever, man.
Yep.
Just knowing that the Marvel movie machine is now heavily involved in what we're going to see from Spider-Man on the screen, I'm good with that. And they certainly found the right actor. And the fact that Robert Downey Jr., it sounds like, is going to be in Spider-Man Homecoming, awesome.
Good.
So, yeah. So, there you go. So, that is your news, which was kind of a lot of news this week. But we're going to get into comics now. Before we do, Matthew, we like to take a few minutes to talk about facial hair. And I'll have you know for a moment that when I went to work today, a person that I work with and have worked with for about 15 years now looked at me and said, "Holy cow, did you shave your beard?" Yeah, I shaved my beard about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I still have my beard,
but
I shaved my, I just rolled out of the mountains from hibernation beard like a few weeks ago. Just noticed it today.
Yeah. I mean, your beard got to the point where you were cutting up newspapers and gluing notes with the letters.
Yeah.
Is where it was going, but looks great. Love it. Now, when growing a beard, you really need to protect that skin under all that facial hair, and keeping that lush beard from drying out will not only keep it healthy looking, but good looking too. So when choosing a product to do so, look no further than Viking Oils. Winterfest Beard Balm and Beard Oils will not only make your beard look amazing, but contain a fresh scent of peppermint or coffee or citrus. The wash and conditioning pack will maintain a healthy look and glow by using the beard's natural oils and helping the sensitive skin under that mane remain healthy and itch-free. So if you are a beardaholic and you want to look good but don't want to worry about harsh or potentially dangerous chemicals, then look no further than the all-natural beauty of Viking Oils. To see the full line of beard care products, go to VikingOilsLLC.com. You can like them on Facebook at Viking Oils. And once again, I told Gary today or yesterday how I appreciated the fact that when I shaved my everything off a couple weeks ago, there were no blemishes. There was nothing but good, healthy skin underneath. And Gary said, "Dude, that's the point." And very appreciative of that.
That should be their tagline. Dude, that's the point.
That's the point.
Just right on the bottom of the bottle.
Yep.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's jump into comics. We just talked about Spider-Man. We just talked about Iron Man. Now I'm going to talk about a comic that has both of them in it. And that is Amazing Spider-Man number 12. Now, this series to this point, the first 11 issues basically was one long story arc involving this this group called the Zodiac. And it just wrapped up with issue number 11. And as we get to issue number 12, Spidey is back in New York and he's sort of, you know, taking a bit of a breather. And there is a fundraiser that he is at. And it starts off with Peter and Harry both sitting in tuxes as they're here at this event. And they're having a conversation, and Harry now, in this current iteration of Amazing Spider-Man, is the head of the New York office of Parker Industries, because Parker Industries now is worldwide. Mm. So there are teams and executives and scientists and everybody else that he has across the globe at this point. So Harry, his best buddy, is the one that's running the New York office. And so they're having a conversation in the beginning of the issue where they're sort of catching up. And Peter is awkward because he's dressed up in a tuxedo and that's not usually his thing. And he's saying, you know, I didn't want to go out and get a $1 zillion suit when I'm asking people to donate to the Uncle Ben Foundation, which is this new initiative that he started in his uncle's name to help people. And Harry's like, "You have no idea how much clothes cost, do you?" And so they're kind of goofing back and forth. And as they're having a conversation, Mary Jane shows up. And so there's this great reveal where Mary Jane's back and they're talking, and you see almost immediately that she's there with Tony Stark. Now, I have not been reading Iron Man, but my understanding is that Mary Jane is now working for Tony Stark. And so as they show up here at this party, Peter's talking to her, and then he kind of looks, and Tony Stark comes over and says, "Oh, hey, Parker, you two know each other, right?" And Peter's like, "You're working for Tony Stark?" And he says, what do you mean know each other? We all lived together in Avengers Tower. Don't you remember back when I helped you build the Iron Spider suit and all that? And Tony's like, no, I'm sorry. I got a lot of stuff going on. It's tough to keep track of. Which, with all the reboots and the, you know, unmasking and the One More Day stuff and all that, like, it's never clear as these characters jump back into Spidey's book, like, who remembers what and that. So him and Stark have a sort of a passing relationship at best now at this point. And as they're at this party, he's talking to Tony, and he's not really liking Tony. And Tony's kind of an arrogant dude in this book here, and Spidey's not really feeling it. And he is definitely not okay with the fact that you have Mary Jane that's dating him. So as that's going on, you have Stark making his way around, and there's this guy by the name of Augustus Roman, who is the CEO of Empire Unlimited. He's at this fundraiser as well. If you read the Renew Your Vows event that happened during Secret Wars, that was the one where we talked about where it takes place in the reality where Peter and Mary Jane are married and they have a daughter, and there was a guy by the name of Regent, and he was someone who had captured and drained all of the superheroes in the world of their powers and was funneling them into this suit that he had, and he was called Regent. Well, as far as we knew, that ended with the whole Secret Wars thing, but we're seeing that this guy, Augustus Roman, is now in the main Marvel universe, and he's going to be a player in the Spider-Man book. So he shows up at this fundraiser as well. And as all that's going on, you have Liz Allen, who is Harry's old wife, who shows up as well. So this whole first part of this issue is all about, like, all of the characters that you know and love, like, running into the people from their past and running into former flames and stuff like that. And so it sort of has this uncomfortable, like,
Company.
It is like everybody runs into each other here. And then when Peter gets up to speak at this event, he gets attacked by a supervillain by the name of Ghost, who appeared a while back in the last version of Amazing Spider-Man. And he can sort of make himself immaterial, like intangible. And so as he shows up, all of a sudden Spidey springs into action. You know, Peter ducks somewhere and puts his costume on. But it's funny because as he's getting dressed, he's like, my armor's on. It's time for... And you hear somebody else say, the one and only Iron Man. And he turns around and Tony Stark has showed up with his Iron Man armor and completely steals Spidey's thunder. And so for the next like 10 pages, you have them battling this villain and arguing with each other the whole time. And Spidey saying to him, you know, if you're really all anti-corporate now and about fighting the man, he says to the villain, you should choose me because Parker Industries is way bigger than Stark. And so they're arguing over who's going to fight the villain. But of course, they end up having to team up to take the villain down at the end of the day. And once they do, everything sort of returns back to normal. But when Peter leaves that fundraiser, he is fuming about this whole Mary Jane thing. So he's like, if Stark is going to work with Mary Jane and now in all this stuff, I'm going to call up Pepper Potts. So he calls up Pepper Potts and he says, Pepper, hey, how's it going? This is Peter from Parker Industries. I wanted to offer you a once in a lifetime, name your own price kind of job here at. And she just says no and hangs up on him. And that's the end of that. So she wants to have nothing to do with him. The next thing you know, we go over to a place called The Cellar, which is a brand new prison for superhumans. And you see that Tombstone and some other guys are being brought into this prison. And you see that the guy who is running this prison, which is sort of a private enterprise, is this Augustus Roman guy. And so what he was doing in Secret Wars was siphoning power from all the different superheroes. And you see, as this issue winds down, that he's doing something very similar with the villains that they're bringing into this place here. And he's doing it because he feels like if he has these powers, he'll be a better protector of not only the city, but the world, than all of the heroes that are out there now. So it seems like they're setting him up to be the villain of this next arc, which is kind of cool because I liked Regent from that storyline. And it will be interesting to see him come into this as a foe for Spidey now, even if it's a misguided sort of foe. Of course, Dan Slott is your writer. Giuseppe Camuncoli is the penciler here. Cam Smith does the inks. Marte Garcia does the colors. And the letters are Chris Eliopoulos. And it is edited by Nick Lowe. I say this every time I talk about this book, but I love Giuseppe Camuncoli's artwork. Yeah. Absolutely love it. I am really starting to kind of dig the new spider suit design. And he did a great job with Iron Man and with everybody else. I just love his style, and I think it matches the action of what Slott is doing very well. So Amazing Spider-Man still going strong. If you haven't tried it out since it relaunched at number one, we're only at issue 12. And this is a jump on point because it is a brand new story arc. And what was kind of cool is that people who went to see Civil War and just saw Iron Man and Spider-Man together in the same movie now can go find a book on the racks that has Iron Man and Spider-Man in the same issue.
And that's the way it should be.
Yep.
You should be able to walk right in.
Absolutely.
So I'm realizing that with the weird weather that we're having, all these
making the stickers go crazy.
I can't even open it. So I'm going to have to save this one for my book. But my first book I'm going to talk about is a book that I was a little excited about because of the writer-artist team on that one, not even the character. So I'll give you the creative team. Becky Cloonan is the writer, and you and I have been fans of Becky for a long time.
Whoa.
You didn't know that?
Are you saying – now, the book that you're going to talk about, of course, is The Punisher.
The Punisher number one.
I already have it waiting for me at the shop because it's The Punisher.
Yes.
So, of course, I'm going to buy the first issue of The Punisher. I did not know that Becky Cloonan was writing it. I love Becky Cloonan's work.
Yeah, and then you also have Steve Dillon, who's the artist on this one. Now,
classic Punisher artist.
Now, Steve Dillon, if you don't know who he is from his Punisher work, if you think of The Preacher, he was that entire look. He, to me, is the Vertigo look. He's the look of an artist that every time you see it, you're looking at a page going, all right, I'm going to turn the page and see something completely heinous and wrong. But his style is so awesome.
I also like Steve Dillon's style, but I will tell you right now, I would be perfectly fine with Becky Cloonan writing and drawing this book because Becky Cloonan's style is stunning.
Yeah. I'd like to see her doing that. I'd like, and I'm sure she might.
If you haven't read Wolves and her other short stories that she had done, she also worked on the Conan series. She was writing Gotham Academy with Brendan Fletcher, and I believe they're still working together and writing that, but yeah, she is amazingly talented.
So you, I guess if you've never read The Punisher before, let me give you a synopsis of the character. His family was killed. He's pissed and he's killing everybody. There we go. Now you're caught up on The Punisher.
And he is in the most recent season of Daredevil.
Yes. So we start out at the Brooklyn Warehouse District and you hear a lot of swearing and things are going on. And then you have this, you've got a guy that's just kind of looking straight ahead and you keep hearing, are you even listening to me? Come in, Olaf. And you turn around and you see this guy who's like a chiseled, grizzled, you know, sort of guy who's been around for a while. He works for the detective agency, or I don't know if he's quite a cop, but he's got the military uniform on still. He's got his dog tags and looks like he's been to hell and back about 40 times. And you got a guy in there going, hey, you know what? I got an assignment for you. And this one is going to be a big one. The next shipment of weapons, it's planned on coming in tomorrow. The DEA is all over us, so we need to take care of this. And it almost looks like he is a guy that has been like deep, deep, deep undercover for an awful long time and is losing track of who he is, losing track of everything. And this guy is in here going, all right, so here's Lloyd and Luther. These are your two guys that you're going to be hanging out with, and they are these two big, huge bulls. And you see them, and you're like, all right, knowing the Punisher, you guys are not going to have a long life. And the guy's like, so can I get back to my job now if you're done lecturing me? And he's like, oh, yeah, well, here, by the way, this group Condor, they're going to be bringing in some heavy armaments. You need to be careful. We need to make this bust. We need to make this happen. And if you don't, it's going to probably kill you and your entire career. So he's like, you know, so you better hope that that doesn't happen. So next we go to one warehouse over. So apparently this group is meeting at a warehouse next door to the warehouse they're going to go into and bust. And you see a guy get out of the car. Or get into a car, and now you see that he's being watched by a couple other people. So you're meeting a few other people. I don't know if these police folks have a long history with the Punisher, but they're watching. It's a guy and a girl. And he's like, yep, so we got the drugs over there. We got the organization, and now we got the face. So they're taking pictures. And she goes, yep, everything's looking good. They go back to the police department, to the DEA office in Brooklyn, and they're meeting with their agents, and they're saying, you know what, tomorrow is basically going to be a war. This is going to be crazy. But I should mention before they get to the police department or the DEA office, as they're walking away in the shadow, you see the white skull of the Punisher.
Someone else is watching the proceedings.
Somebody is watching. So they're going in and they're saying, all right, this is the guy that we're looking for. This is Olaf. Now they're talking about the guy that we just met earlier, the chiseled, grizzled guy. They're saying he's former military. He's been with Condor since their days as a mercenary outfit. He's armed and very dangerous. And this is going to be a tough one. This is not going to be a cakewalk. So When I'm reading this, I don't know if he is an undercover agent or he just is a bad guy. So I think Becky does a great job in kind of setting up a confusion on who is who, which I really liked, because now I'm like, wait a minute, what? Is he a cop? What's going on? So as you turn the page, you have, you see this big wall where, if you know a lot of guys that have tools on their wall and they have the outline of where the tools are on their little board, you walk in, you see all these heavy armaments, and it's the Punisher's little warehouse. So he goes in.
Because those are his tools.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Those are his tools. So now we go, and we have Olaf, who is watching on video, seeing all this stuff, and you got these two guys over there going, hey, is that your gun? Which old are you or your gun? And then the other guy goes, well, that one's got historical significance. I think that's the one that killed Lincoln. So the guy is like, you know, the gun is old, seen as a lot of action. And the two kind of goony guys are really trying to lay into him about his age and saying that he's an old guy. When all of a sudden an explosion happens, Olaf turns around and he looks over on the screen and he goes, F me, it's Frank Castle. And then you see the Punisher in there just shooting everybody up. The two guys leave the room and, you know, they're running to go get him. And they're like, kill him at all costs. And as you hear the over the loudspeaker, kill him at all costs, you're seeing dudes get headshots. You're seeing guys laying there with their guts hanging out. And Olaf goes, you know, you can't kill Frank Castle. So then you get a classic shot for the next three or four pages of just Frank Castle dismantling everybody, shooting everybody up. Now, as this is all going on back with Olaf and the two other guys, the guy gets one of them gets his gun. He's like, I'm going to go down there. I'm going to take care of Castle. Then Olaf turns around and shoots the guy and says, you're not going to do anything. And then he starts to walk away. Meanwhile, you go back and Frank is just taking care of these guys, blood everywhere. And he gets a metal pipe from the ground and jams it through the guy's stomach. And then you see the high voltage box behind him, jams it through there, and then electrocutes the dude. And, as this is going on, he picks up a cinder block and proceeds to beat the heck out of the other guy.
Yeah, he's basically like a walking horror movie.
Yes. And then before he can come down with the death blow of concrete on skull, the guy he was ready to hit gets shot. And typical Steve Dillon fashion, you've got the entry wound, the exit wound, and the eyes are like googly all over the place.
What I'm also noticing amidst all the carnage that you have there in front of you is, who is the colorist on that book?
The colorist is Frank Martin.
Now, that person does not usually color Steve Dillon.
I don't know who usually does. On the cover, it's interesting because when you see Clune and Dillon and Martin, I thought all of a sudden Laura Martin. Laura does all the colors for everything. But it is Frank Martin.
Because it seems like there's a different color palette there, which is actually making his artwork look a little bit different than it usually does.
Yeah. So then as he is going to come down, you see that Olaf comes out and goes, hey, Frank, you know, you don't want to do that. Then you find out that Olaf was Frank's commanding officer when he was in the Marines. So there is a connection between the two guys. And he says, hey, you know what?
It's like Commando.
Yeah. Yes. Minus Alyssa Milano in it.
Alyssa Milano, correct.
Yep. You're not going to kill me, are you? And then he whips him down the hill. Great, great movie that I remember seeing it when it opened. And
Wasn't Commando the one where the guy said, you said you'd kill me last?
I lied. Yep. Yeah. And then you had the big guy who looked like Freddie Mercury from Queen.
Yeah, that was the guy who used to be in the military.
Yeah, steroid-laden Freddie Mercury. So this guy's telling him, going, hey, you know what? I'm just giving you a friendly advice right now. This is a huge thing that you might not want to get involved with. Yeah, you killed everybody. You did your job. You did what you like to do. But get out of this right now because this is not going to end well for you. So he's like, hey, see you later. Semper Fi, Frank. And he leaves and Castle's sitting there. Looks like for the first time ever, Frank Castle's kind of thinking about things like, huh, maybe I should maybe think about this. And within the military, even if you don't like your commanding officer, you have a lot of respect for that person. That person was somebody that has turned you into the person you are, good, bad, or indifferent. The next morning, you see the DEA crew. They're all with their guns. They're all getting ready. They're all doing the hand signals to go in. They're all creeping in and being quiet. They kick open the door, and as they open the door, death everywhere.
Yeah.
Punisher was here. So blood everywhere. They see the dude that has been frying up on the electrical box for the last three or four hours. And So one of them goes, is this from a rival drug interest? And the woman officer picks up a shell casing on the ground and goes, nope, this makes it the work of one man. And they're like, what do you mean, one guy? No way. And she goes, have you ever even heard of Frank Castle? Look at the patterns. And you see the patterns are shots to the head, you know, just dismantled human beings everywhere. And he's like, who could have done all this? And she goes, you know what? I got a pretty good idea. He's got a heavy, high body count. And that's just the way it goes. Now we go over back to the guy that we met in the very first page who was talking to Olaf, saying so it was the Punisher that we confirmed that he was in the warehouse, and now it's crawling with DEA agents. And he goes, so it's kind of unfortunate that this all happened. And he's talking on the phone with somebody. And as he is there, he is getting a bloody knife, and it looks like he's like kind of tapping it into, or he's tapping something into the ground, into something. And then you turn the page and you've got a guy that is like getting faces of skin and mounting them on the wall.
Huh.
So I don't know who that guy is, but
it's an interesting hobby.
What a way to end the book. And again, I am not like the biggest Punisher fan, but when Punisher is done right, I love this book. And by right, I mean having Dylan drawing it and having somebody like Becky Cloonan. And now Becky's script, again, this is a book that, and it's a guy that you could almost think, all right, I'm going to write a story and it's going to be the Punisher walks in and just shoots people and that's the end of it. But Becky seems to have some story that's going on, some underlying thing, because there's moments in here where files are left in a particular place. Like you see Olaf walking away after the bloodbath and you see on the desk a file sitting there. So I'm wondering and thinking, is Frank going to be set up for something? Not to mention the fact that when the guy left the warehouse early, he kind of looked like Frank Castle. So wondering what's going on with that.
Well, there you go.
Yep.
I will definitely be reading that series for sure. But now we're going to jump over to IDW, Matthew.
And we're going to jump over to IDW after, too.
That's exactly what we're doing here. And we're going to get into the very first issue of Dungeons & Dragons Shadow of the Vampire. And this was a $5 book, but it's an oversized book, written by Jim Zub.
Jim Zub.
With art by Nelson Daniel. Letters by Nell Uyatake, edits by John Barber, and published by Ted Adams. So, Jim Zub, of course, Skull Kickers.
Yep.
And a billion other things. He does Disney comics. He's not only a super nice guy, but writes comics that are very fun. He does the new Thunderbolts.
Yes, he does.
That's what we talked about last week.
Because of your review, I picked it up last week.
Yeah, very fun.
Yep.
So, I know when I buy a Jim Zub book, I'm in for fun.
Yes.
He has fun making comics. He writes comics that are fun. And when I'm reading a D&D comic, and if you go back a few years in this show, there was IDW has been doing D&D comics for a while now, but there was one that featured a group called Fells Five.
Yeah.
And it was the best run of the D&D comics that I had read in years. And then for whatever reason, they stopped that run and started up some new stuff. And I didn't like any of it. Mm-hmm. I tried a couple of them. I didn't like it. There was a few different limited series that came out. So having Jim Zub come over and write this, and he just wrote a Baldur's Gate comic that some of these characters appeared in. But having him over here doing this book, especially when you've seen his stuff on Skull Kickers, like this is the guy you want writing a D&D book.
Yes.
A D&D book is supposed to be scary at times, funny at times, but full of adventure. And this book definitely is, because it starts off with a group of adventurers who are trapped inside of a church, and there are a bunch of skeletons that have dove through the window. And the one of the guys who is kind of like a ranger is saying, "Furry invaders, you shall not prevail." And you notice that on his shoulder, he has a hamster, and the hamster squeezes. So it's a little bit of a Squirrel Girl type of vibe going on here. And you see that a huge fight is ensuing where you've got legions of the undead, but also werewolves that are running around in this building and fighting off our adventurers. You have a looks like another ranger, a dwarven ranger. You have a human fighter. You've got another ranger. You've got a sorcerer. So they're all there together, and you see that they are a band of mercenaries. And it goes back to 12 hours earlier in the day, and they have been hired for a job through, you know, various tavern and backwater channels to help out this church, which is called the Temple of Kelimvor, who is the god of the dead in this world. So they're going to this church where the people worship the god of the dead because they have need of a group of adventurers, which is basically how any good D&D adventure starts is you go to the tavern, you go to a new city, you go to the marketplace, you pick up a job. Somebody needs help. Somebody needs something done. You sign on to do that, and then craziness ensues after that. So he's on the right path already. So we get to this place, and he meets with a guy by the name of Albi, who is the priest of this particular god. And they're talking about how this church holds a lot of different relics that in the past few nights, it seems like somebody has been trying to break in and steal. And so they don't know what's going on, but they need a group of adventurers who are going to stay there for the entire night and find out who has been trying to sneak in, what's been going on, and basically stop anybody from getting any of the precious artifacts that they have here that are all tied to their religion, and some of them very powerful. So as the main priest is telling the adventurers this, a woman bursts through the door and says, "Father Albi, why would you call upon these faithless sellswords?" And you see that this is a priestess by the name of Neris. And she is a priestess of this church, but she's a warrior. So she's kind of like a cleric in D&D terms. And she comes in and she's saying, "I can protect this place by myself. I don't know why you've hired these guys. They don't even believe in any of the stuff that we do. Let me do it." And the other priest says, "Look, we need some help. You can certainly stay here with them, but we're hiring these guys." And so the adventurers are trying to, you know, sort of make nice with her. And the guy with the hamster is saying, "Hey, do you smell that, young cleric?" And she's like, "What? The sweet scent of adventure wafting up our mighty nostrils." And so you could see that that's sort of the tone that he's going for. Well, then we flash forward to where we were when we started this comic, which is in the middle of a battle, and they are battling undead skeletons and werewolves. And so between the entire group, they manage to take out the skeletons, but the werewolves are looking for something and they're talking to each other. And one of them saying, "You know what, just take the death cleric. She'll tell us which one it is that we need." And they grab all of the artifacts. So not only did these adventurers fail to stop someone from breaking into the church, the things that broke into the church got all of the artifacts and stole the priestess of the church as well. And so they pretty much screwed up this job in a way that they'll never get paid for it. So the next thing you know, the priestess starts waking up and she sees that she's being held captive by this group of werewolves that have now transformed back to their human form. And they're saying, "In these artifacts that you've had in your church, there is one particular artifact that we're looking for and you need to help us find it." And of course, she's not very inclined to do that. But they say, "If you don't help us find them, then we're going to destroy all of the artifacts that have to do with your church, and then you'll have completely failed as a priestess of this church." Now, as this is happening, the hamster that belonged to the ranger has actually hitched a ride on this priestess, and she is whispering to it because apparently it can understand what you're saying, and she's basically sending it to go and get the others. And so as they're talking, she decides, "All right, I'll help you guys. I'll look at these artifacts. I'll tell you which one." But she ends up telling them it's the wrong one because she's stalling for time in time for the rest of the crew to get there. And when they do, they burst down the door and a huge fight ensues. And as they're battling, you have the werewolf saying, "You know, we need this locket. We need its protection." And she's saying, "Protection from what?" And one of the werewolves says, "It's too late. He found us." And the whole room fills with this mist. And all of a sudden, when it clears, they all find themselves in the middle of a forest, including the mercenaries. So you have the werewolves who are saying, "You know, we're screwed now." And they're like, "Well, what's going on?" And one of the werewolves says, "This is our prison, the realm of our master, Count Strad von Zarevich, Lord of Ravenloft." Now, if anybody out there is a D&D fan, then when I just said Ravenloft, you probably jumped out of your chair, because Ravenloft is one of the absolute coolest settings that ever came out for D&D. And the premise behind Ravenloft is that it is this world that is constantly changing, but it is made up of different domains. It's basically like a gothic horror world, and it's made up of different domains. And in each domain, you have someone who is kind of trapped there, but is the ruler of their domain. So imagine, it's almost like when we talked about convergence and you had all these sort of bottle worlds. Imagine a world where there's little slices of other worlds in it. And in each of those slices, there is one person who is sort of all powerful, but they can't leave that little slice of the world. And so that's basically what Ravenloft is. And it was introduced in 1983 with a adventure where the characters ended up in Ravenloft and this vampire, Strad von Zarevich, was the villain. And so in the very first issue of this series, we are seeing one of the great D&D villains of all time, and probably the coolest setting that was ever created for D&D in this first thing. And now the adventurers, because they would not listen to these guys, have found themselves stuck there as well. So I am 100% in for the rest of this series. This is pretty much exactly what I want from a D&D comic. And if you have fond memories of old school D&D and Ravenloft, then I cannot recommend this highly enough, because it is exactly what you would want it to be. I can't wait until we see Jim, probably at New York Comic Con this year,
yep,
to talk about this series, because I know that he's a fan of D&D, and being able to play with these toys is gotta be just like a dream come true.
And when I interviewed him at the Albany show a few years ago, it was that thing where I'm interviewing him going, yeah, he's got to be talking to Brian, because he definitely has more in line with
Brian. Which is so funny, right? Like, we have those times where we're in the middle of an interview, and some interviews we do cold, which is basically we're walking down Artist Alley, something catches our eye, we start a conversation, we end up interviewing somebody. And I think over the years, we've gotten to be a pretty good judge of who should interview who, or who will click with us. But every once in a while, we find ourselves in an interview where we're like, oh man, Matt's knowledge of this would have been really, really helpful here. Or, oh, this is Brian's nerdy stuff. Like, this would have been better. So, that's funny when that happens.
So IDW to IDW again. Uh-huh. And this is a book that last year at Boston Comic Con, when I was talking to Chris Ryall, he was excited beyond belief that they picked up the Micronauts license and they picked up ROM Space Knight. Now, ROM and the Micronauts were a toy line that were out in the 80s. ROM was basically one figure that came out, and it didn't do, I don't think it did very well, but the comic ended up lasting probably 6 or 7 years, and people have a lot of memory about that. And
for sure.
Up until about 2 years ago, ROM and the Space Knights kind of were part of the Marvel Universe. There was a, I think, who was it, Flash Thompson? Is Flash now a...
Flash no, is a Space... He's a Space Knight. Space Knights are part of the Marvel Universe.
Yes.
ROM is no longer.
Yes.
So in one of the series that they did, when it was after the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, there was a series where Silver Surfer was in it and a bunch of other characters, and they were like space defenders or something like that. But there was an actual Space Knight who was in their group, but not ROM.
So the story of this one, if you want to get ready for a great creative team on this one, plot and script by Chris Ryall and Christos Gage.
Well, there you go.
So you got a couple of heavy hitters right there. David Messina is doing the pencils, inks, and colors on this one. Now, it's really interesting because I did not read the ROM comic up maybe after issue 7 or 8. I don't know why I just got away from it. But what I remember is basically ROM comes to Earth looking for people. And this story is so reminiscent of the first issue. Obviously, it's not a complete ripoff of the first issue that came out as the Marvel one, but it has so many little nods to it where you're like, whoa, I remember that, because reading this was such a joy. It just kept snapping everything back. Now, this also was a free comic book day book. This was the one book that I had to get, and thankfully I was able to get it. So we start out in Northern California, where you've got a couple of officers that are driving, and they're talking about stuff as they're going up to what they think is just a little fire that got a little out of control. And they're like, oh, it's got to be a bunch of kids. Yep, yeah, this is what happens. So as they look in the rearview mirror, they see lights behind them. But then all of a sudden, they slam on the brakes because there is like this military half-track vehicle in front of them. And they're like, so what do you think this is? And they're like, well, apparently it was a little more than a fire that we're dealing with. So they get out of the car and they're like, so why is there armored transport here? The officers get out and they're like, hey, we're these people. Is there anything we can do to help you? And he says, you know what? Just be quiet. My men have this under control. We're not alone here. And then all of a sudden a light goes on and you've got ROM there, and ROM is speaking in his language. Obviously, the two Earth officers are completely panic-stricken by this, and they don't know what to say, what to do. And as ROM has his arms up in surrender, you see that his voice translator is kind of going through all these different languages until it gets to English. And he's saying, I mean you no harm. My energy analyzer is going to reveal all. And then you see the three soldiers that are there all of a sudden get into military stands, and they're like, armor's powering up, take him down. So they start shooting at him, Rom gets bounced back and he's like, your crude weapons caught me off balance. And then all of a sudden you see the things on his wrist. Like before he used to have this thing that would come out. That was his energy analyzer. It would be like something he would hold and the toy, it would light up and make noises.
Sure.
So this thing,
that's what energy analyzers do.
That's
Matt,
what they do.
Or at least they did when we were kids.
So on the backs of his hands, he has these like red discs. They start to glow. And he goes, you have failed. And you see that two of the soldiers that are there with him end up, or one of them ends up like shrinking into a blob. And everybody's looking around like, oh boy, what's going on? And you realize and see that one of the soldiers was a bad dude that was coming after Rom and that he is on the earth. And everybody there is watching this going, what just happened? This alien just killed a human being. And as they're watching and seeing this thing going down, all they're doing is hearing Rom explaining and talking, saying, you've done this. You're the Dire Wraiths. You've done more damage than anything. And you're here and you're not going to invade this planet and all this. But they're not seeing anything about what's going on other than that. So they're like, all right. The two officers are thinking, all right, we got to take this alien down. He's killing these people. And then the Dire Wraiths that are there, the two other ones, start to show their actual ability or what they look like. They're these ugly looking things. They've got wings. They tear after one of the officers and they grab him. And the one soldier that was left that thought he was just doing a military thing is like, I don't even know what just happened. What happened to my men?
It's a little bit above his pay grade, Matthew.
Yeah, this is getting a little bit confusing, and I don't know what's going on. So then Rom goes right after one of the Dire Wraiths. They have this little bit of a battle. He zaps it, kills it, and then tells the soldier and the one remaining officer, saying, your Earth was invaded a long time ago. Now I am here to help you take care of the Dire Wraiths. Rom the Space Knight has come, and I'm going to make this war my own. And that's how it ends. And they're both like Dire Wraiths, and the other one's like war. And you see that the battle has just begun. You get a couple pages of some concept art to see.
I love the concept art. I love the sketchbook stuff. Yep. And they do that a lot with the Free Comic Book Day books, and that's always cool.
Yeah. So you get to see all the things that are going on and how he's going to look. And then I turn the page, and I got incredibly misty because there is the Bill Mantlo Support Fund. Now, Bill Mantlo was a writer at Marvel who wrote Rom, the Micronauts, he created Rocket Raccoon, was a very prolific writer for Marvel during the late 70s and the early 80s. And probably, I want to say about 1984, 1985, somewhere around there, he was either jogging, riding his bike, and got hit by a driver and was left for dead. It was a hit and run. So there's somebody out there that did this. And he was in a coma for probably 10 or 15 years. And I don't know exactly where he is health-wise right now, but there is a support fund here, and you can go to Bill Mantlo, MANTLO.com, for more information. And I love the fact that in a comic book, ad space and page space is valuable. And for Chris Ryall to not only want to use the Micronauts and the Rom properties, but he is so... just knows the lore, knows the life of everything that's gone on. They decided that they were going to put a page in here, and they put it in a Free Comic Book Day at page to spread the word about this, which I was really touched by. I thought that was an amazing thing. There's an ad for the Micronauts, but then you go through and then they do a Transformers reading guide to give you all the reading, what you need to do.
Well, keep in mind now, this is a wonderful time for IDW to have these licenses, because we just talked a few weeks ago about how Hasbro has created a film division.
Yes.
To do a shared universe with the Transformers and with the Micronauts and with all that. Yeah. So this is the ground floor of what is going to be their plan, is to have like a Marvel and a DC and type of thing, where it's a whole shared universe of all these different properties. So this is just the tip of the iceberg.
And there was a 3 or 4 page story at the end of this, Action Man. Now, Action Man, if you are a toy guy or you might not know the history, you might have heard the name. Action Man was the British version of G.I. Joe. because obviously G.I. Joe was government issue, so that wouldn't have translated very well over in England. They wouldn't have understood that. But the concept of a 12-inch soldier
yep.
that did all sorts of crazy stuff, obviously any kid, any country, anywhere sure. is going to love that. So the Brits had Action Man, and Action Man evolved into almost like a Captain Action kind of character. They even brought him over in the States, maybe about 1989, 1990. I remember working at KB and putting Action Mans on the shelf. It's a cool thing, and this story is almost making him like a soldier of fortune adventurer. And the creative team on that one is John Barber, the writer, Chris Evenos is the artist, and Jean-Paul Bove is the colorist. But the 3 or 4 page sample I got in here is making me want to read this book as well. So IDW is doing a great job with their, I guess you can say, the toy licenses.
Or as I like to think of it, the nostalgia line.
Yes. Doing a fantastic job with that. I mean, throw G.I. Joe in there too.
Yeah.
They are doing
which is also part of the shared universe. So yeah. So they're perfectly poised to be creating stories that are going to have a major impact on what's happening in the movies
yep.
for years to come, because this is a big plan that they're putting forward here.
Yeah, and IDW is celebrating their 50th anniversary in comics, which does not seem right.
It's amazing.
Seems like it was yesterday, and it seems like it was. They've always just been around.
Yep.
And I will tell people right now, and I know you feel the same way, if you are somebody that is disillusioned by Marvel, by DC, you're kind of caught off guard by some of the things that are going on, why don't you take a chance on some of the IDW books? They've got the Ninja Turtles. They've got everything there for somebody.
And not only that, but there is literally something out there for everyone.
Yeah.
Comics are so much broader than the big two.
Yeah.
And the subject matter is so much broader than superheroes and spaceships. There is something for everyone out there. I just had in the Facebook group for Thrash It Out, somebody was posting about a heavy metal comic that I had never even read. I think it was called Sing No Evil.
What?
And I was like, what is this? And we started talking about Black Metal by Chuck Beebe and going on. And so it's like, that's metalheads way over here talking about like comic books yeah. that are into heavy metal. And so like there is something out there for everyone. Like we don't always get into a lot of those different subjects here on the show. I think we try to do a pretty good job of being diverse in the books that we talk about, but you know, we don't always accomplish that, but that is something that I'd like to do more of, and that you should be checking out all the stuff that's out there. Even go on like comixology.com. Especially if you're not near a local comic shop
yeah.
and just browse through their digital storefront. Even if you then decide to go buy something in print afterwards, that's fine. But just to take a look at what's out there, especially with their submit program, you've got all these great indie books that are on there. But man, with IDW and Dark Horse and Boom and Oni and Archie and all these other places that are putting out, and Devil's Due is making a major comeback
yes.
right now. You know, like there's so many great, Action Lab, another one, like there's so many cool publishers out there that are doing so many different awesome things that, you know, take a walk away from the big two for a little while and check out some of this stuff, especially if as you said, you're getting disenfranchised with
yeah.
that stuff. You know, if it's not clicking with you, don't walk away from comics, just walk away from the comics that you were reading.
Yes.
And go find something else because it's out there.
The interesting you said that about the heavy metal comic. I got a Facebook message from somebody who said, oh, love the Striper podcast. I started listening to Secret Identity and absolutely love it. Do you know anything about the Striper comic that came out about 10 years ago because I'm trying to find it? And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? There is a Striper comic
yeah.
book out there somewhere.
See, those little treasure hunts that we go on, and especially now that, you know, you were talking about Hudson Valley Comic Con, and it, you know, we're going to be looking at some of those first year and smaller shows to go to. Those are the places where you find that stuff.
Yes.
Where you go to the vendors who have the 10-cent bins and the 25-cent bins. Like, that's where you can find some real treasure. So I think we need to bring some of that stuff back to the show and talk more about that stuff. But as we head down the home stretch of today, we're going to wrap up with our creator spotlight. This week, my good friend Alana Abbott reached out to let me know that she has a brand new game coming out from Choice of Games called Choice of the Pirate. Now, Choice of Games, as you'll hear Alana talk about in this interview, is very much like a choose-your-own-adventure game. So if you grew up reading Choose Your Own Adventure books or Endless Quests or, you know, Time Machine books or any of that stuff, then these are games that you can play on the web, you can play on your phone, but they are Choose Your Own Adventure books that are more robust than the stories that you were getting in those books. And this is Alana's third game. She's done Choice of Kung Fu, and she did Showdown at Willow Creek. And she talks about a few other ones that she really likes on there as well. But her new game comes out the 20th of May. And as you listen to this, it's not out yet because this should go up on Monday. But I will put links on our website when it goes up. And if the link is live, I will put it in the show notes. But you can always go to choiceofgames.com to find all the games that they've done. And that's where Alana's game will be up as well. That's the best place to go, as you'll hear her say in the interview. Now, her son, Nathaniel, makes a couple of cameos in this interview because I happened to be home with my son the other day because he was sick, and we ended up connecting. So she was home with her child. I was home with my child. And you hear over the course of the interview that there's a couple times where he wants, he needs mom.
Yeah.
He needs mom's attention. You know what I mean? So it's pretty funny, but we had a great conversation. It's always great to catch up with her. And I would be remiss if I did not talk about her trilogy of books that has recently been completed. The Redemption Trilogy. Regaining Home is the latest novel that came out, which completed the trilogy that has been, now it was a 10-year odyssey to bring that trilogy to fruition. And a wonderful fantasy series that I love. I'm putting a link in the show notes. You can get those books over at drivethroughcomics.com, and I'll put a link to Alana's website in there as well. But she is your creator spotlight for this week. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
This is Brian here, and I am here joined for the first time in a while by our good friend Alana Abbott. How are you today?
Hello, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. We were just catching up offline about our lives with kids and all the interesting things that are sort of happening in the meantime, and just looking back at, like, it blows me away how long, A, we've known each other, but B, that we've talked about different projects that you've been working
on. That's true. We're coming up on 10 years, Brian.
I know. That's crazy.
Because my first novel came out in 2006, and you were one of the first people I talked to about it. So,
and I don't think I've talked on the podcast since I finished the last book in the trilogy, Regaining Home.
I liked your posts in the middle, so I hope the ending was satisfactory.
Holy crap. I mean, I know we have another subject to talk about today, but we will definitely do a podcast where we do like that director's commentary.
Oh, awesome. That's fun. I like doing that.
Yeah, that is honestly one of my favorite series of all time, and to see it come from, and maybe it's because it's actually tied to our relationship that I have like this
maybe,
like, extra layer of love for this series, but getting to visit those characters again, getting to see that story through was just really, really fantastic, and it now is on my mental bookshelf of like my top fantasy series of all time.
Oh, yay. Well, I'm excited. I'm hoping that as part of the release that we're going to be talking about, I also want to be able to tie in some promotions to the trilogy. And I'm hoping that by the time the new game comes out, I will also have the trilogy up available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, which
awesome.
Is in the next 10 days. So I got some work to do with formatting my ebooks.
Oh, man. That is like formatting the ebooks. That's a special kind of hell.
You know, it is. And I'll tell you what, I had a friend who has been self-published for a long time, and he's a longtime publisher. His name is Jeff Dunteman, and you should totally look him up.
Okay.
But he told me that for him, you know, he does all of the formatting and he does direct to the sites and whatever, because he makes the best the percentages by doing it the way that he does it. But I told him, you know, I have it up on Smashwords. I have it up on Drive-Thru Fiction. And if I want, I can just tell Smashwords to go ahead and distribute for me.
Uh-huh.
I said, honestly, you'll get better money if you, you know, if you do it individually. But if it's not there, you can't make any money at all. So if you're not going to have the time to do the formatting, just let Smashwords take care of it. At least then people will be able to buy it. So That's my thought in the next 10 days, is that if I can't get the formatting done, I'm just going to say, Smashwords, you go.
Well, that's fantastic, and I totally agree with you. I mean, that is the That's the hardest part, is when the book is done and you want to share it with people and you have to get it in the formats to go on the sites, to be put on separate platforms and all that kind of stuff. That is in some ways like the most brutal thing, because not only are you dealing with the formatting piece of it, but it's like the thing that's standing in your way of just like being done with it and having it be out there. Right. So, yeah.
But I'm done, but I'm not done.
There's exactly. It's like the book is done. I feel so relieved. Oh, no, I have to do all the formatting. Oh, great. Awesome. That's a whole nother thing. So, well, good luck with that. And we will absolutely spread the word about that, because I can't tell enough people about that series and that book. And now with the trilogy being out, it's like, here, just go read this whole thing.
Right, right. It's a nice thing to be able to say that it's finished. You know, yes. You pick it up, you're committing for 3 books, and that's it, and you're done, and you don't have to wait, and there's no cliffhanger in the middle that I feel so guilty about, that I left people hanging for many years.
But you know what? It made it all worth it in the end, because we all got to come back and visit those characters. So, and I'd like to think that it was even more satisfying for the people that have been along for that entire ride.
I hope so. And I especially hope that the people who found it in print were able to find it on ebook when it came out.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So I can't wait to just continue to push that and share that with people. But let's talk about your new Choice of Games game that is coming out soon, which is Choice of...
The Pirate.
Choice of the Pirate. So you've done Choice of Kung Fu, and the second game was called...
Showdown at Willow Creek.
Yes, Showdown at Willow Creek. So the first game came out in 2012, right?
That's right. I think it came out in time for Christmas 2012 was the idea.
And you were one of the first like games out on that platform, weren't you?
I was fairly early on, especially with the number of games that they've released now. They have quite a number in their catalog, which is fantastic, and they're a very wide variety. But there had already been several games before I was brought on board, so.
Well, I'm looking at their catalog now, and it's absolutely huge. And so you have the new game coming out now. For people who don't know what Choice of Games is, and maybe didn't hear the last time that we talked about this, what's sort of the elevator pitch for the type of games that they make?
Well, Choice of Games is a lot like the old Choose Your Own Adventure books, but with a lot less of the random turn two pages and die
right
aspect of it. It's for your phone. If there are possibilities to die in many of the games, there's peril, but there's also a promise that you're going to have a reasonable span of time to play. You're going to get some really good story before anything comes to a conclusion. And then, of course, you could get a happy ending. You could get a weird ending. I've played some that I don't know how well I did, which is very much like real life.
Yeah, it's not as cut and dry as, you know, you fell into the infinite hole and you're dead.
Right, right. Or it's not, hooray, you're the king of the universe. It's,
exactly, right.
Wow, I accomplished these tasks, but now I'm not sure what the moral of the story is.
Yep. Which is kind of awesome, but it keeps the spirit of those books alive. And I know that for me, like, I grew up on those books. That was one of the things that fueled my imagination along with Dungeons & Dragons when I was a kid. And so I think a lot of us who probably enjoyed role-playing games really found a way into them with those sort of choose your own adventures. So to see that come back and to see the scope of topics that people are taking on for games over there, everything from spy stories to superheroes to ghost stories to Wild West stories to vampire stories.
I have to tell you, one of my favorites is the wrestling game.
Which is what? Do you know what the name of that one is?
Slammed.
Awesome. I will link to that in the show notes.
It's absolutely, and I did not expect to be drawn into this game about professional wrestling at all, and I loved it. I loved it so much.
I will definitely put a link. I'll put a link to the site itself, but I'll put a link to a couple of the games in the show notes too, just so people can check those out. So Choice of the Pirate, tell us all about that.
Okay, so Choice of the Pirate draws very heavily on sort of the Hollywood pirate mythology of romantic, dashing pirates at sea. And it plays with a lot of the tropes. I don't commit to, you know, the yees and the yars all the way through. In fact, the only pirate who really talks like that is he's the first captain of the main character who you play. And he's a horrible pirate. He's an awful pirate. And that's sort of his introduction to the game, is he's the only one that talks in this ridiculous way.
Uh-huh.
So what I wanted to do with Choice of the Pirate was have a classic pirate adventure. You know, we didn't kidnap the governor's daughter, but we did kidnap a secretary at one point.
Yep.
And, you know, we have the treasure hunting aspects and the sea monsters and the storms at sea. And there's a chase from a crown spy if you choose a certain path.
Well, I mean, basically, if you're going to sign on for a pirate story as someone who is picking up this game, I think you probably have a mental list of the things that you would want a pirate story to include. And it seems like you've kind of hit on all of those boxes.
We really tried. When I sent my pitch initially to the Choice of Games team, they said, well, I think you've hit just about everything, but what about this? And I said, oh, that's a really good one. I'll make sure to work that in.
Nice.
So we really tried to tick off, you know, what do people think of when they think of pirate adventures, and how many of those tropes can we incorporate and then play with in weird ways? So one of the goals you can have as the main character is to become a famous pirate by the end and perhaps even become the next pirate king. And the pirate king is a mysterious figure who sort of looms over the Lucayan, which is the area of the world that's replacing the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
Or if you are a loyal citizen of the crown who's just been trapped into piracy and conscripted by an evil captain somewhere along the line, you may choose to work for the crown and become an agent for the crown spies and try to undermine the power of the pirate king. And so those are the two sort of main paths, but of course there are different ways to interpret that. And you can switch sides pretty much throughout the whole game.
What I love about this series of games is that, and we talk about Choose Your Own Adventure before, but like that for me was what those books were when I was a kid. Like they showed you everything that you'd want in an outer space story or a spy story or whatever. And so the fact that you have all of those opportunities, and these games are more robust, as you talked about, in terms of the different storylines that can play out and the options that you have.
That's a great word for it. Absolutely. I think they are more robust.
It's a little bit deeper. And so the systems that are working there offer you more choices. But also on the flip side of that, those systems are systems that you have to write for. So as the person who is creating that game, when you sort of take a step back and you do a zoomed out view of what one of these games looks like, you could probably wallpaper half of your house.
Oh, it's so much text. It is so unbelievably much text. And it's fun. I mean, it's, having the background as an adventure writer for Dungeons and Dragons and also as a fiction writer of novels, it is this hybrid in the middle that has to work in both ways, right? So it has to work as a game, but it also has to work as a story. And you don't have that sort of improvisational tabletop interaction that you would have if you're writing an adventure module for Dungeons and Dragons. Where the players can sort of take the game in a totally different direction and
sure.
You just roll with it, right? I mean, you try to bring them back to the story. But they give you ideas and they give you feed as you run a game. But in the case of Choice of Games, you don't get to interact with the players until after they're done playing it most of the time. I mean, there's no way to know, except when you're in playtest, well, how are people going to look at this aspect? How is that going to play out? Is that joke actually funny or is it horrible?
Right.
How is this going to work? And so it's definitely that hybrid area of like with a novel, you don't get the feedback till it's done either, but your person, the reader, isn't a character in your novel. The reader is a character in the game. So it's
right.
It's fun. It's a really good middle ground compared to the other types of writing that I've done. And I really enjoy it. The coding is definitely a new area of skill for me. I had, I've worked in publishing for a while and I had some skill using XML and HTML, but these games are all written in ChoiceScript, which has lots of if statements. It has a, you know, if you go here, then you have to find this label to continue the text. And then when the texts go back together, does the sentence lead in properly? Is the punctuation cut off in a weird way? I mean, the technical aspects of it are very challenging, and I'm still learning. I have the copy editors say, well, you can't do this. And I say, oh, I'm sorry. And then I fix it.
Well, I mean, first of all, I completely admire the fact that you're basically learning another language in order to even be able to put these games together. It reminds me of like the old micro adventures books that I grew up with, where you would basically end up doing basic code on a TRS-80 Radio Shack computer to make different things happen. But, you know, you say that it's a middle ground between D&D and writing fiction, but it's kind of the hardest of all of those three things because, like,
in
writing fiction, you know, you have complete control, right? You paint the whole world. You say everything that happens. In the D&D stuff, you're sort of creating almost like signposts of like, okay, these tentpole things have to happen. How we get there, why we get there, what choices are made in between. You can roll with the punches because you're sort of outlining like we have to get to these things. These are going to be the big things. But with choice of game, I mean, you are basically going down the road of all of those if-then statements. You are writing all of them. You have to sort of account for every choice that they're going to be able to make in the game and make all of those meaningful and then have interesting things happen so that it's not that there's just one path through the game and everything else is sort of underserviced. You have to make sure all of those choices feel like they pay off.
So one of the things that I think is so great about having playtesters, especially early on in the game, is that I can have somebody say, well, I really wanted to do this. I wish that was a choice. And I had a few really awesome, right, like in sync with what I was trying to do with the game kind of playtesters who really got it and who had invented sort of ways to look at their characters that they thought could be better represented. And I thought, those are great ideas. I'm going to use them almost verbatim from your email.
It's always nice when and I'm sure that the people that are playtesting for Choice of Games now have done a few of these, so they probably have a good feel for how the games work and sort of what feels like maybe it's not as robust as something else in the game. So that's immensely helpful.
And you know, they do, and they all have different preferences, which is something when I'm taking the feedback from the playtesters, I have to look and see, okay, so do you get it?
Right.
Are you my target player? And I want everybody to enjoy it, of course, but there are some people who are going to enjoy a game and there are some people who maybe that's not their thing. And it's not going to be like everybody finds Slammed like me and says, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I didn't expect to love it as much as I do.
Right.
You know, it just might not work for some people. Hopefully it works for everybody, but you know, you don't have to try and please everybody. Just like with a novel, not everybody's going to like the same stuff. So you just try and find those people who are already like in your headspace and you utilize them as much as possible. And then you listen to everyone else too. But you try not to take criticisms too hard to heart because that can be really discouraging.
Well, and like you said, players are so different, right? I mean, just even, you know, having played, I know you're a role-playing game fan. I'm a role-playing game fan.
Yep.
I'm making my way through the Dark Souls series right now. And in that game, there's a billion different builds that you can put together to play that game in very different ways. And so what someone wants, you know, in terms of hack and slash versus someone else who wants more of a espionage-based type of game.
Right.
In all of those different settings and all of those different genres, there are still multiple ways to make your way through. And some people just want to hit stuff all the time and have everything be very action-based. And other ones want, you know, more of a story. And trying to find that balance and please everybody, you know, as much as possible is super difficult. But this is your third go-around.
This is my third go-around. And one of the things that I worked on a lot this time because I had I'd been pinged on it before in reviews for the other games was that the criticism I had received was that the relationship options weren't complex enough. So I tried really hard to make really interesting relationship options in Choice of the Pirate. And Choice of Games has a real commitment to showing diversity in options for sexuality. And so I try to embrace that also as much as I can, which also means people just want to be friends with everybody. They should have that option. They shouldn't have to always default to romance if they don't want to. So I tried to make the NPCs deeper than in my two previous games, especially for the relationship options. And for some people that worked. And for some people who, like you said, wanted to hack and slash through the game or who wanted to really focus on skills, they just skipped or they missed the options to talk to the NPCs. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Well, you chose not to talk to them, so I guess you missed that part.
Well, and like you said, I mean, not only have you been able to take feedback from the playtesters and look at what some of the feedback was on your previous games, but by the time you go through this process a third time, there's so many things that you've sort of refined internally that does it finally feel now like you've settled into, all right, when I'm making one of these games, I know what I'm doing now. I feel like I have a good grasp on all aspects, or is it still presenting new challenges?
Every time I start planning a game, I think, okay, what can I learn from the last time? What did I not like writing?
Yep.
For one, I had the structure in Willow Creek was a huge challenge. And I had tried to make that a certain kind of game, and it worked a certain kind of way. And I ended up not being very happy with how tight the structure was. The time frame for that game is only a few days. So I went back to the structure closer to Choice of Kung Fu when I did Choice of the Pirate. So it's more over a scope of years. Here's a look at, you know, several years of your career as a pirate. And there are things about that I really enjoyed. For my next game, I don't think I want to do any relationships at all because they were so hard to code, and I gave so many different ways of how you could interact. Oh, my goodness. And it was just the coding for that was ridiculous. So I will probably not have quite as complex an option base for the next game. But then, of course, by the time I finish that one, maybe I'll say, oh, I really missed doing those really complex options for, you know, who knows?
Sure.
But I think everything, I learn so much every time that every game I take a new set of things that I've learned and things that I want to try differently. And then I learn all over again whether or not those things work.
And as you said, not everybody's looking for the same thing from every story. So having a solo adventure or an adventure where the character is not dealing with a lot of different relationships might be completely in somebody's wheelhouse and they would totally love it.
Right.
So when is the game coming out?
May 20th.
May 20th, it comes out, and people can get it on all of the, you can get it on the Google Play Store, they can get it on iOS, right?
I believe that it'll be released to those all at the same time. The best way to find out, though, is at Choice of Games, and that'll have the links to everything that's live at choiceofgames.com.
Yep, that's choiceofgames.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and I'll also put separate links to not only the games that you've done, but also a couple of the other ones that we mentioned here. And people should absolutely check them out. If you've ever enjoyed a Choose Your Own Adventure book or an Endless Quest book or anything like that, I think that you would completely love this series of games. And obviously, if you're not familiar with Alana's writing by now, you need to get familiar with it. And I will continue pushing the Redemption trilogy as much as possible. Now that that trilogy is out, do you ever think about those characters in terms of, I'd like to write a short story involving them, or I'd like to check in on them, or I'd like to do that, or do you want to move on to something completely different now?
Honestly, I don't think I will ever revisit those characters just because of the sort of the weird situation with the way things went with the publishing.
Uh-huh.
And I don't, there's a part of me that has just a little more to say, but there's, I think, a bigger part of me that just wants to let it stand.
Yeah. And I think it does stand. I mean, again, I think that if people, again, were along for the ride, then they saw what it took to bring this series to fruition. And I think a lot of times people don't appreciate the amount of work that goes into actually taking a story idea and then bringing that to the point where you can then share it with the world. When you add in all of the stuff on the publishing side, and especially in the role-playing game industry where things seem to change daily and all of that kind of stuff, the fact that that trilogy now exists as a trilogy and is out there and is – it's an amazing thing. I mean, that in and of itself is its own story.
It is. It's true. It's true. And it was a struggle in a lot of ways, but I'm just very happy that it concluded well. You know, I made a promise to somebody at Gen Con 2006 when we debuted the first book. He said, oh, I don't buy trilogies. And I said, if you buy this book, I promise you all three books will be out. And that that promise in 2006 was one of the things that kept me thinking, all right, how am I going to release this? Eventually, have to do something with this because I promised that guy if he bought my book I would finish the trilogy.
Sure. And I love series. Like, for me, I often feel like when I read, not that I don't like one and dones, but when I read a book and I love the characters, I want more of those characters. And it doesn't have to go on forever. It doesn't have to be, you know, Game of Thrones, and it doesn't have to, but to have a trilogy, to me, that just feels like a nice arc for characters.
It's good. And it's easy to recommend a trilogy, too, because it's not the huge commitment that a 10-book series can be. As much as I love some of those also, it's like I'm always a little nervous to say, oh, you should read this because then you have to read 10 of them.
Absolutely. So you've got your trilogy of novels. You've got a trilogy of games out now.
I do. That's true. But they're not related for one.
No, but people should play all three of them.
Oh, thank you.
They should absolutely go and check them out.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, I'm not finished. That's definitely something that I'm going to continue to do. So
that was kind of going to be my last question: is in addition to continuing to make choice of games, what other stuff do you have going on that you can talk about? That
sure. Oh, no problem. I have a few short story commissions, actually, that came from the Kickstarter that are well later than they should have been. But I have one that's in progress about a superhero who is dealing with his electromagnetic powers.
Okay.
It's not an origin story, but it's sort of it's supposed to be a funny story. And I have a couple of other superhero stories that are in various states of being done that I would like to sort of tie all of those in to be in the same universe. And who knows what will happen with that, but then I'll have my own little superhero universe.
Well, I was just going to say that doesn't that immediately speak to the D&D nerd in you where
it does. It's like, I have to link them together.
Yes.
Because they're, why not? They could happen in the same universe.
They totally could. That is like, everybody I know that writes and also has grown up playing role-playing games, there is this world-building, like, mutant gene that gets activated in you as you go, as you play these games when you're a kid. And, like, any story that you tell in the future, you spend so much time thinking about the world.
Yes.
And how it connects to other stories. Yes. And all this kind of stuff. And it is that is something I am constantly, like, having to keep myself in check around, because even like the stories that I write with my friend Jolene, I'm like, well, that technically could be included in this universe. If we did this, right, it could connect back to these other stories. And it's just because I think those connections for those of us that have played D&D, which, you know, we've played in campaigns. You ran a Greek mythology campaign. I played in a campaign where someone had linked Planescape and Forgotten Realms and Ravenloft. And so D&D was all about like linking everything together and making everything feel connected.
Well, you know, even as a kid, when I was reading Madeline L'Engle, she has the Wrinkle in Time series, but she also has a series that doesn't have any real science fictional aspects in the main series. But they happen in the same world, and every once in a while there will be this character shift. So you'll see characters from one book show up in the other continuum, and you have to say, whoa, this is a normal world, but science fictional stuff happens, and these other people don't even know about it. And that's always been kind of appealing to me, to have that, well, there's a real world, but there's this other stuff that you don't see, but they still happen in the same world.
I love that. I love that idea.
That's cool.
So, well, I'm looking forward to your shared superhero universe.
Thank you. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
When that all comes together. And congratulations.
Oh, thank you. The other really exciting project I have coming up is I've just taken a role with Outland Entertainment, which is a comic studio. And I'm going to be doing editorial work for them as sort of, I don't know what my position is officially called yet because this is so brand new, but I'm going to be the editor working with the artists and the comic writers to get everything in ready and all the T's crossed and the I's dotted and making everything ready for publication. So that is going to be super exciting to be working in an editorial capacity with a bunch of writers and creators and artists, and I'm really stoked about it.
That is fantastic. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you. I have high hopes for it all going very well.
Now, is this a new company or is this just a new role that you're stepping into with an existing place?
This is a new role that I'm stepping into. You know, back when I was working on Cowboys and Aliens.
Yep.
As a writer, I was working with Jeremy Moeller, who was the editor for that project. And Outland is his brainchild. So he is the head of that company and I'll be working for him.
Awesome. And that's a long-standing partnership, so that's pretty awesome, too. So
that is. No, I always, anytime I have a chance to work with Jeremy, I'm like, yes, sign me up. So I signed up.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about the projects
Definitely.
That are coming out of there as well. So
definitely. It's going to be fun.
So if people have not gone out and got the Redemption Trilogy yet, go and get that. You can go to the link in the show notes to and go to choiceofgames.com to get Alana's new game, Choice of the Pirate, but also the two previous games that she worked on and the other games that we talked about. So as always, it's great to see how much stuff you have going on, and I can't wait to catch up again. We won't wait so long this time.
I hope not. No, it's always fun to talk to you, so I'm glad we got to do this.
I know. It just so happened that I was home today because my child is sick. And so, yeah, that's what happens. And when we first met, I don't think it was 2006. I had my daughter, but my son had not. I don't think we had had my son yet. So I had one child at the time. Life was a little less crazy at that time. And
it's true.
And now here we are. And so it's
four kids between us.
I know. It's unbelievable how time flies. So, but it's always great to catch up with you. And I hope the game is a smashing success.
Thank you. I hope so too. I hope everybody really enjoys it.
Great. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.